My name is Clancy Imeslund, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I'm very glad to be here tonight. Glad to be at the 17th Annual Cajun Country Conference. And I know there's some new people here tonight. I don't know what brought this up in my mind, but Betty, an outgoing trustee, got up here and said a few words. And you may not be, if you're new, you may not exactly know what a trustee is or even a delegate. But Alcoholics Anonymous is set up kind of like the government of the United States. And we are really a very democratic organization. Tonight we have Betty, a trustee, who's just going out of office. Carl Budd is here also, who's just going out of office, another excellent trustee. Some of you were present at the International Convention in Minneapolis and went to the big meeting. And if you were like me, you were shocked to discover they didn't say the Lord's Prayer at the end of those meetings. So I immediately got a hold of Carl Budd and gave him hell. He had nothing to do with it, but I didn't care. He's a trustee. Screw him. And Bob, your speaker tomorrow morning, was in charge of the marathon meetings. And I didn't approve of one or two of those people, so I gave him hell. I made a few mistakes myself, but I was tolerant to them. I'm an easygoing kind of guy. But I am very glad to be here, and I'm glad to be in Louisiana. I don't know why I feel kind of poignant tonight, kind of a little emotional, a little emotion of gratitude, I suppose, a little emotion of, I don't know why I was on the plane today, and I was thinking of, we were landed in Dallas. I remember living in Dallas and living there, and that's where I came to the end of the run. Just my wife took the children and left me when I was often drunk, and just I came home, and they were gone, and just my clothes were on the floor. The furniture had been sold, everything was gone, and I had been burned off there. It's just, and I couldn't imagine why this was happening. I look back, I can see now that I was gradually going downhill for a long time, but it seemed I was kind of keeping even, and I really wasn't. I got thinking about that today. Think what a sick feeling that was. They'd repossessed my car. They evicted me from my house. My wife had taken the children and left. I had no money. I had no place to turn. And everybody that I knew had said I couldn't get a recommendation in my work anymore. I couldn't do anything. And shortly after that, I had to get out of Dallas because I was on parole or probation from the Texas State Insane Asylum. And nothing to do with drinking, but they had me defined as a schizophrenic with paranoid tendencies because I'd been a successful suicide that had been revived, and so they put me in the insane asylum. And I knew that my wife, what they did in Texas in those days, maybe I don't know if they did it in Louisiana, but I guess they did it in Will Rogers or in Huey Long's or Earl Long's time anyway. But you were released to your wife's, she was your parole officer. And I'll tell you, at any time, they'd just tell her, if he starts acting funny, just call us up. We'll come and get him. And that makes a little tension around the house, I'll tell you. Don't you think you better get the garbage out? Somebody, I'm going to kill you, bitch. But since she had left me, I knew she probably turned me in. And I had no way to get out of Dallas. But in those days, maybe still do, they had driveaways, you know, where you could get a car. If you want your car sent from here to Chicago, you'd go to this company, and they'd deliver it in Chicago. The way they do that, they find someone who's got a license and fairly reputable, and they drive them. They add them paper, you want to go to Chicago, and you can drive. So and I got some guy's car to drive to Los Angeles. I got as far as El Paso. And I got drunk there in Juarez with some old friends. And I got to Phoenix, and I got drunk there, and I got in a beef with some cop, and I got thrown in jail overnight, and I lost the car. Couldn't ever find that again. And about a week later, about a month later, I guess 3 weeks later, I found myself in Los Angeles being thrown out of a Skid Row mission, and I couldn't believe it. And I just didn't know what to make of it. And these thoughts are coming back to me today. Yes, an interesting thing, though. All of us in this room have been driven here by pain. All of us have been driven here by conflict. it isn't a competition. They, you know, we hear these great stories about about all the Johnnies been in the penitentiary and people been in the nut houses and people done all these things and all these hideous stories. Remember when I was new in AA this time, and we'd hear some woman get up and talk in the meeting. She'd, "No, I'm just a housewife." And they'd, "Oh, Jesus. Not another housewife story. Why can't we have a convict like we had last year? Why can't we have a certified new schizophrenic or something?" But it's an odd thing. As the years have gone by, I have come to almost shudder when I think how glad am I wasn't an alcoholic housewife. That's their stories worse than mine. I couldn't have done what they did. I think of those housewives, I listen to their stories now, they have to, no matter how they feel, they have to get up every morning, they have to get those children ready, and they have to take care of them, they got to get their husband off and somehow hold it together and maybe watch their drinking to the neighborhood, judging other women in the neighborhood, judging them all the time, and you have to be careful how they buy it and what they do with the bottles. And no matter how you feel, you have to be ready when the kids come home, and you have to have dinner ready, and you have to have the clothes washed, you have to take care of the things, and you have to all look like you got it all together and sit through the night, go to take care of the responsibilities, and go to bed and get up the next morning and do the same thing. And there's never any end to it. There's never a vacation, just on and on. I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that. I just, to hell with it. I had it easy. I ran away from time to time when the pressures got too bad. And everybody has gotten here feeling bad, feeling desperate, I'm sure. And I'm sure most people have been like me and think, well, if I'd like to go back with my life, a woman asked me one time years ago, what would you change in your life if you could change something? And I selected several different things. I would change that, and I would change that. But as I've got older and wiser, I think, I've come to the reluctant conclusion I wouldn't dare change a single thing, because all of them were necessary to drive me to surrender. And one, because I didn't surrender very easily. You know, we were talking at our table in June. They had an A&E special on the TV about AA, which was kind of interesting. I think overall they did a good job on it. Especially 2 weeks before that, 2020 had done kind of a scurrilous attack on AA. And this was it was very good. I remember in January, I got a call from the World Service Office in New York, asked me if I choose to be interviewed for this program. And I said, sure, you know. So about in February or March, they came out and a meeting hall of ours called Ohio Street, the whole south wall was windows and glass and doors, and they found this sunny afternoon, so the sun poured in from behind me, and I sat there as a silhouette, and they asked me some questions and talked about things. And because you have to maintain anonymity, in case you're new again, that's what anonymity is. It doesn't mean that you can't say you're an alcoholic, but it must say that you must not publicly say you are a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not to protect AA, it's to protect you. Because people have a tendency to do things for their own self-aggrandizement. The people who break their anonymity seem to suffer much more than AA ever suffers. And I believe, because of the nature of my work, I'm on television a lot, and I'm in the newspaper a lot in Los Angeles, but I never break my anonymity. But when I saw that camera there, and it was going to be on all a national network, and probably all over the Western world, and the camera started rolling, I just had a terrible temptation just to kind of go. I fought it off, but it was nip and tuck, I'll tell you. But the guy, he started off, you know, when they ask questions in these kind of interviews, I've had thousands of them, I guess, they give you puffball questions, like, well, what, how many members are there in your organization? Where do you meet? And And he started right off from Bangville. He asked me some questions. They never got on the air, but I don't know why he asked me. I guess he had some reason. He said, why is it that some alcoholics don't have to go to AA and they stay sober, and you alcoholics say that you have to go to AA? And I know alcoholics who don't go to AA and they're sober. How do you explain that? And that's absolutely true. Anybody who's been around very long knows there are some people who seem to stay sober. In fact, I've had them call to my attention. Why can't you be like Leo? He drank and he did something about it. He stopped. Maybe I'd like to kill Leo. But there are no doubt about it. There are people who are, by any test you can give, alcoholics, but something happens, they are threatened, or their life is threatened, or their sobriety, or their family is threatened, or they lose a job, or somebody dies, and they suddenly are shocked. And, I quit! And they quit. And there are also people, a type of alcoholic apparently, who are not only emotionally addicted, but become physically addicted. These people have to be, hopefully, medically withdrawn. They're the people for whom treatment centers were originally created. And at each step of their withdrawal, they're taught, look what's happening to your family. Look what's happening to your life. Look what's happening. And they suddenly realize, what a terrible thing. And they quit, and they never drink again. And then there's another type, some other types of alcohol. For example, people who are alcoholic and who are threatened, their security is threatened, some maybe lose their family, or they're threatened of losing a family, or a job, or something terrible. And they quit with sincerity and devotion, but always drink again. And there are those who are withdrawn medically, treatment centers, various hospitals, and they see the error of their ways, and they quit, but eventually always drink again. And these are the people that baffle medical people and baffle religious people, have been baffling people for thousands of years. Why would you do that? And those are the people that are called, those are people like us. You know, when Bill Wilson wrote this book in 1938, it was an inspired book, I believe, because he wrote about things he wasn't really qualified to write about, and he did very well. But one of the things, he knew there were these types of alcoholics. He didn't really understand them very well, but he knew about us, but these other kind of people. So again and again in our book, he refers to alcoholics of our type. Alcoholics of our type. He doesn't talk about what the other types are. But our type of alcoholic, we are the people who are baffled everybody and baffle ourselves, you know. And probably one of the worst bafflements is when you've been drinking and stop drinking and make a new vow and you stop with or without a solemn oath, as they say, and try to read spiritual literature and take physical exercise and do these things. And no. God calling. Get that mooch off the podium. When you're a backslid Lutheran, there's no rest. But I'm not a backslid. I used to be. But you know, this to me, the sad thing has always been when you start drinking again and when your family. I've seen that look in my family's eyes, that look of, how could you? How could you? You promised and you were doing better. And the kids were getting settled down, and we're starting to just get along. And how could you, after all that's happened, how could you drink again? And it just makes you feel as bad as anything can make you feel. Because I don't know the answer. So all you can do is say things like, oh, leave me alone, damn it! Get away from me! Which makes them feel worse, but it makes me feel bad too. I don't know why. And this is the problem. And probably the worst thing about alcoholics of our type is that each of us secretly feel someday we'll be alcoholics of the other type, that one day we'll quit, it'll be over. And we die waiting for that time to come. And that's the great bafflement. But all I could tell this guy when he asked me that question, he didn't want to hear that whole thing. I just told him there are just some alcoholics, small percentage of alcoholics who apparently can stop drinking, and nobody knows why. A vast majority, maybe 90, 95% of people can't do that. They think they can, but they continually must drink again. Then he asked me the next question. He said, why is it that alcoholics go to AA? Okay, these alcoholics that you say have to go to AA, they go to AA. Why is it that some of them can stay sober and some of them can't? If it's supposed to be working, why does it? And that's absolutely true. I'll tell you, if this table here were all newcomers tonight that have some big meeting, and you all went to the same meetings for the next year and went to you could have the same sponsor, I suppose. In a few weeks, a couple would be gone, and a couple more would be gone. And pretty soon, at the end of the year, you'd have a small number of people getting the first birthday. And what happened to all the others? Nobody knows. Well, some of you know. And the irony is that some of the ones you think would be the most likely to stay here don't, and the ones who fringers and negative boobs hang around. And they change little by little. You know, I'm off the bed about that. That is kind of funny in meetings because everybody's ever worked with new people. I like to sit in meetings and have somebody up there. I'm only a month sober, but I found a new way of life. And I owe it to all the wonderful people like you. You've shown me a way to live, and it's just given me a new excitement, a new interest in living. I just can't tell you how grateful I am. Thank you. And some goof gets up and says, well, I have to come here and get my court card signed. And I don't know if I even like this place. I got a sponsor who seemed to not understand at all what the hell I'm talking about. And it's just, I don't know, I'm here and that's all. And 11 months later, that second guy is getting a birthday cake and that wonderful man is gone. Who knows? I suppose maybe the reason is the second guy was trying to be honest and the first guy was trying to please everyone. I suppose, I don't know why that is. But he said, why is it that some people, why don't you stay sober? And I had to really, it made me stop thinking about my own life. Now, I am not a masochist by any way. I'll tell you, I hate pain. I hate physical pain. I hate mental pain. I don't mind pain for you, but I don't want it for me. You can have mine even. But there is a certain amount of pain in life, but I don't voluntarily ever choose pain. And so I got to remember, when I first came to AA, I was in jail in a little town called Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I just stood in jail over the weekend. And a guy had come to take one of the guys in jail to an AA meeting, started, and I was kind of informal. And he said, oh, I've read about you in the paper, kid. You want to go to an AA meeting? I said, sure. I went to an AA meeting, a bunch of old fools, 40s, your old gray-haired boobs. And nice. But I mean, it had nothing to do with it. I thought they were nice people. They meant well. And they said, if you come here, you'll get rid of all these pain you're having with your drinking and problems. You won't go to jail, you won't have pain, you won't have this conflict. I said, good, you know. And since there was a cessation of pain there, they promised eventually, I had to wonder, then why did I kept going to AA off and on, why did I slip year after 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 year? The worst years of my life came after good people were trying to help me in AA, in different cities and different places. I came as kind of a medium to high bottom drunk, I guess, and then I became kind of a medium bottom drunk, some ups and downs, and finally being thrown out of a Skid Row mission. And there was no explanation for it. I went to AA from time to time. I went to AA in Dallas. I went to AA in El Paso. I went to AA in California. I went to AA in Chicago, Milwaukee, Minneapolis. I went to AA wherever I lived when the heat was on. But it did take me long to realize I'm not like these people. And it didn't surprise me because I'm not like anybody else either. I've often thought, I spent my life trying to find the place I fit. I'm not sure there are people here like that. I moved from city to city and job to job and think, this is the job that's going to be good. This is the town I'm going to fit in. And pretty soon it turns out I don't fit here either. And this isn't it either. I suppose if I had one underlying phrase in my life, although I never consciously said it to myself, but I can look back and think, this isn't it either. This isn't the woman either. This isn't the job either. These aren't the friends either. And on and move on again. And absolutely become convinced that I have a lot. I know I have problems. I've known I've had problems since I was a little boy. I don't fit into places very well. I don't get along very well. And there's something missing in me. I don't know what it is, but it keeps me from feeling comfortable with people or something. I don't know. I spent thousands and thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to try to find out what was wrong with me. And I found out some good reasons. I mean, I found out, for example, that when I was a boy, my parents were divorced. That doesn't seem like much, but I lived in a very tight Norwegian Lutheran family where there'd never been a divorce. In fact, I don't think I'd ever heard of a divorce. My parents got divorced when I was 12. I just didn't know what to do about it. And what I did instinctively, I should have known something was wrong, but instinctively, my parents got divorced, the first divorce I ever saw, without even missing a beat, I began playing my mother against my father to avoid discipline. And I was 12 years old, and I was getting straight A's in school, and I was doing fine. And after outsmarting my mother and father for 3 years, I was being flunking out of high school as a junior. But I outsmarted them all, I'll tell you that. I was. That seemed to be the doctor pointed out. I said, yeah, I can see that now. And when I was a kid, I could read fast, read well. It made me restless and irritable to wait for the other kids. So they shoved me. They didn't have any special schools or classes, so they just shoved me ahead a year and a half in school. And I was up with kids I could read with, but now I was much smaller, and I went from being kind of a leader in the beginning of the third grade to being that dumb kid at the end of the fourth grade, never being called out to play on their teams or do anything. You know. And that's why I started being a smart aleck and having to show off and show off something. And he pointed out that I'd lived in poverty during the Depression. I didn't know it, but I could see later that I'd been hurt a lot. And on and on. I used to run to that doctor's office and just have a drink or two and think, no wonder I drink, for Christ's sake. It's just my life is a series of I've been hurt a great deal. And now there may be people here who they'll tell you, don't go to psychiatrists. I loved it. I found out ways that I'd been hurt that just, it made me understand that it wasn't my fault. Another thing I found, I'd been repressed by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. And I had been catechized, I could sing little songs in Norwegian, I was really pretty good at it. And now it turns out they'd repressed me. If I knew then what I know now, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. You could hire a couple codependents and sit around and be pissed off every week. But you know, for people like me, the bad thing about psychoanalysis was that it struck me after a while, I felt so good I knew what was wrong, what was causing these feelings. It took me a long time to realize I now know what's wrong, what causes these feelings, but I still got the feelings. You know, I feel bad, but I know why. That's a minor pleasure. But the only use for that information might be late at night in a bar somewhere, and some big moose could go to, hey, I've arrested you all night. What the hell's wrong with you? And you can tell them. I was repressed by the Norwegian Lutheran Church, and my parents got to know. When I was 15 and I was funky out of high school, fortunately for me, the Second World War came along, and I told my mother I wanted to go to Superior and visit my aunt, and instead packed my little bag, gave me bus fare to go to Superior, and said I took that money and hitchhiked to San Francisco. Dumb little pimply-faced puke, didn't know what the hell I was doing. I got one ride from Minneapolis to San Francisco, and guy in the Navy, going back to the ship, apparently. And I look back and think, why would he do such a thing? You know, a dumb kid, had no money, he bought my meals, but not during a motel, just stop at a trailer court and give me a bed. And I'd just talk, and he'd talk, and just, he must have been, I'd like to find him someday and nominate him for sainthood. And so I want to be in the Marine Corps and kill Japs. Probably you're kind of small for that, and your pimples are coming out a little bit. But your merchant marine is crying for people. Why don't you go to the merchant Coast Guard office and see if you get merchant marine papers? So he showed me how to go there and said, just mark down your 16. Good luck to you, kid. Remember, he left me off on the Oakland Mall, which is the pier in Oakland. A memory I sometimes forget, but when I think about it, it just almost sends a tear down my cheek. He put me on a ferry boat, It was a thick, foggy morning about 6 o'clock. I stood in the spirit. I never smelled the ocean, never dreamed of these things, and went across, and the sun was coming up, and out of the fog came San Francisco, the hills and the tall. God, the smell, just to this day, that's a great, one of the great. And I found, got there, got to the Coast Guard office on Market Street, and put out an application. And I put down 16. The guy said, well, you're only 16. You have to have your parents' permission on this. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission, brought it back. And they issued me seaman's papers right there, because all the good sailors had gone to the Navy. They were just crying for any warm body. They sent me down to the National Maritime Union. The guy showed me how to get to Montgomery Street with my little bag, and I signed a waiver for my union dues or something, I guess. The guy said, you gotta get on a ship now. So they gave me a ride to the Embarcadero and put me on a ship. And that afternoon, I was on my way to the South Pacific. You know, that's kind of a fast adjustment. And it was fun for a while, but the guy said, there's Treasure Island. That's where the World's Fair was last year. That's Alcatraz. That's the Golden Gate Bridge. But the damn ship just kept going. Pretty soon there was nothing to see. And I think I had the intuitive feeling that I'd made the first in an endless series of career mistakes. And they stuck me in a room, they called it a forecastle, but a room with three of the worst type of people that any small, skinny, dumb, pimply-faced Norwegian Lutheran kid could be with. And these people are called men. And they, what the hell are you supposed to be? I discovered later why they were up that way, is because I was the fourth man on their four-man deck watch. There's supposed to be four guys working, and they looked at me and realized they're going to do all the work, and I'd probably just spend instead of working on my pimples. But I remember lying in my bunk, the ship moving around, and I felt so bad. Oh, God, I wanted my mother to say anything. And then these guys start talking. And they had been in San Francisco apparently for 3 or 4 days by that time on that ship, and they had been doing terrible things. I mean, I'm a Lutheran, and I may be a bad Lutheran, but I'm a bad Lutheran is better than what they were, I'll tell you. And I was so shocked. And I said to me, of course, these people all have black hair. These must be the Catholics I've heard about. Oh, man. I don't want to give the wrong impression. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And these guys were doing it with people, if you can imagine that. But after about 3 or 4 days, I found a role on that ship that seemed satisfactory. I became the ship fool. Yeah. Hey, kid, go down the engine room. Tell them we need a left-handed wrench. Hey, kid, go over the bridge. Tell the captain we need some elbow grease. And these guys used to sit around in the afternoon after the watch and drink whiskey. They all had whiskey bottles. They weren't supposed to, but nobody ever cared. And one day the guy turned to me and said, hey, kid, you think you're man enough for a little snort? He shoved that bottle in my face. And I'm stupid, but I'm not a sinner or a Catholic. And I just want to tell him how I choked up. I'm so emotional. I want to just say, how dare you stick that whiskey in my face? I may be dumb and I may be just a kid, but I'm not going to be like you, drink that slop. I promised my mother and grandmother I'd never drink that stuff, and nobody that I know that's decent drinks it. Now, just preparing that answer, and he said, well, you think you're mad enough? And I heard a voice say, God damn right. Turns out I'm a little weak under pressure. So I took a drink of whiskey out of the first whiskey bottle I was ever close to in my life. And it burned my mouth and my throat, and my stomach and my throat, and my mouth, and his shirt the last I saw him. Just, get the bottle working on somebody. I thought about that a lot of times. It sticks in my mind. One of the great, I don't know any emotion that I know of that's worse, more painful than public humiliation. when someone really humiliates you and you can't do anything about it. It's kind of, you can see why people take guns and shoot people. If I could, I'd want to hit them, I wouldn't dare do that. I thought later, there's only one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. They'd have thrown me overboard, but I could have said, lean over, you.
Yeah.
Take that. Just give them one in the old eye, just teach them a lesson. But all the way across the Central Pacific, every day I went out and got a sea bag to take a drink of that slop, and I hated it, and I'd throw it up, and I'd have to wipe it up so they wouldn't know. And we were coming into Pearl Harbor, and they're still digging up ships. The day before my 16th birthday, I remember that. I was down there one more time, taking a drink of that crap, and it stayed down. And I couldn't breathe. And all of a sudden, I find myself feeling significantly better. And I discovered why people drink whiskey. It makes you feel better, that's all. I didn't think much about it. You know, when you're a teenager, you don't really think what all this means, the overview. It's just you find out things, some you like, some you don't like. And that's the thing I liked. Nobody in my family smoked. They all smoked, so I smoked and puked. And one day I didn't puke, and I smoked 2.5 or 3 packs a day, every day for the next 47 years. I learned to lust effectively. I learned to curse a little bit. In fact, I was thinking about this. You know, today, I smoked for a lot of years. Eventually, because something happened in my throat, they had to take out part of my vocal cords. It wasn't caused by the smoking, but the doctor said, I would suggest you don't smoke anymore because you may go mute. But the doctor would tell me for 5 years, for you to drink or for you to smoke is to die. Okay, doc. But the first time he said, for you to smoke is to go mute. God, I chewed that Nicorette gum about 50 pieces a day. But they did take out a part of my vocal cord. That's a funny thing psychologically. I remember going to our meeting, Pacific Group, and want to talk to a baby, and I couldn't talk. I had to carry a pad and a pen and write. And instinctively, they take the pen and write the answer. I am mute, you dumbbell. I am not deaf, for Christ's sake. But I have not had any cigarettes since then. But I'm still a smoker at heart. I think if the doctor would come to me and say, you've got 3 months to live with some hideous disease, I'd go get a carton of cigarettes to this day. I just fire up. And it hurts me the way smokers are treated these days. You drive down the street, you see them crouched outside of doors, you know. Pretty soon they'll have to carry a bell and say, unclean, unclean. And they were doing that even when I was still smoking. I mean, you could still smoke inside, but there were still people. I stopped smoking in 1985. And in early 1985, when I was still smoking, there were still, at that time already, there were people coming up, I think they had the right to say, why do you smoke? You shouldn't smoke. You're total strangers. You just want to smash them. But I look back at those drinks I took in that ship, and I suppose in retrospect, because I never knew much at the time, but in retrospect, it was the first time I ever felt the way men looked. And I think it's safe to say that probably 95% of my drinking was spent to feel the way men look, to be like something. And I never realized men don't feel as well as they look, so I was feeling better than they were. But I didn't know that. And alcohol was a great thing. Later on, I went to another ship, and I went in the Navy, and that's just kind of a dumb thing, too. Today, you can't hardly pick up a paper, it seems like, without reading some new hideous thing about children being, young people being molested or being sometimes by teachers or clergymen or just passersby, and it really is terrible as a father of a number of children that bothers me. And I look back at my life, 15 years old, hitchhiking all the way across the country, getting on a ship with the scum of the earth. All the good sailors had gone in the Navy. These are just scum, the dregs of America's world ports, and spent 2 years almost, a year and a half with these terrible people, and was never molested once. It makes you feel unattractive. But better on I went in the Navy. When I was in the Navy, I was at the end of the war, in the Naval Hospital up in California. They were sewing me together, and they passed around some tests at that hospital. I've always been good on tests because I read a lot. And they gave me a high school diploma, so I went back to Wisconsin after the war and went to college after the war. Got married. Married a lovely black-haired girl who turned out to be a Catholic. My grandmother went into a depression for 2 years. And I went out in the world and became a sports writer. Incidentally, old people here, remember Hank Bauer? Remember Hank Bauer used to play outfield for the... He and I came in on the same plane today, and it was fun talking to him. I told him I used to be a sports writer, and I'd written about him. He was very glad. He's here to play some golf tournament. Good guy. And then my wife began doing what Catholic women do all the time. I didn't know it. She began having babies with monotonous regularity. I became a national distributor of small Catholics. I remember talking to her and saying, can't we use birth control? No. She had something called coitus interruptus, which I thought was kind of a goofy situation. It'll add to your nervous tick. But I started to get better jobs to take care of the family. I got into advertising and public relations. All these years I drank and smoked and lusted and did a lot of things. And sometimes I have a tendency to get a little bizarre when I drink. The psychiatrist pointed out to me once upon a time that I'd been repressed as a child, and this was just my bursting loose from my psychic bonds. And I remember trying to explain that to a cop one night. And so I went to AA off and on when the heat was on, and I thought maybe AA could help me, but very soon I realized it couldn't. And I went to AA when the heat was on because it took the heat off. I can come back to my wife and say things like, well, Charlotte, I'm going back to AA. Good. I think it'll work this time. I just know it'll help so many other people. And what do they want you to do? Well, they want me to taper off. And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Okay? Since they started Al-Anon, there's never a moment's rest for anybody. No, they don't. You don't drink it all. But I realized my problem is not like theirs. Because something I noticed, I couldn't describe it then, but I can describe it now in retrospect. The difference between them and me is when they seem to stop drinking, they get better. And I stop drinking, and sometimes it's good for a couple of days, sometimes it's good for a week. But eventually, someone sneaks into my bedroom late at night and puts an invisible spring in my stomach. And when I get up, you start to turn that spring. The days of irritability and restlessness and discontent come, and depression. Why can't I drink, for God's sake? Idiots shouldn't drink. They don't understand. And when you're young, it isn't so bad because you can, go on the wagon. Okay. I'm okay, I'm going on the wagon. I'm going to get off it for a few while. And you stop drinking for a while, and good. Okay, I proved I can, and now you're starting to get a little edgy again, so you have a couple drinks. That's all. But when you get old, it gets bad, because now when you stop drinking, you got to promise people. You got to promise your family. You got to promise your children. You got to promise your mom and dad. You got to promise your employer. You got to promise a judge somewhere. And it gets bad, the spring is there, and one day you just can't drink. And it's just ridiculous. They don't understand. My problem is not drinking. That's the one thing that eases me off. And a guy in his fifth step, once upon a time I was listening to, told me something that I think, my God, he told me. I don't know how he identified it. I never identified it myself, but he did. And I saw it in myself so clearly. And I could see myself doing this again and again. Finding yourself getting very, very just uncomfortable and somehow setting up a beef without even being aware of it with the person you promised. Okay, you want to be that way? I stopped drinking for you, damn it. Now you act like that. Why the hell should I stop drinking for you? And I've done that again and again with my family and people and places, employers, and never realized I'm setting it up because I need to drink. And I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler, because I have all these emotions. And that's why it's such a shock to me. One morning, finding myself being thrown out of the midnight mission on Skid Row in Los Angeles, where I didn't know anybody. One guy, I guess I knew. And they said, "Ed, stay out of here, you bum." And I stood there, and I'd been in and out of AA for almost 10 years. I knew all about AA. I'd read the book. I knew more about AA than most of the people had told me about. I could tell them they were misquoting the book sometimes. And I'd done everything I could think of to do, and I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what the feeling was, but I could see it in retrospect. I drew a point where there was no friendly direction. You got to a point where there's no place to get back to. There's no direction that if I go there far enough, someone will be happy to see me. And I just couldn't imagine what was wrong with me. And some guy came up to me and said, "Why don't you go back to AA?" I'd have to say, "Are you crazy? I'm not an alcoholic. I wish to God I were. It would make my life so much more simple. I wish my life were simple like that. I'd stop drinking in a New York minute. But you don't understand. My case is different." Nobody really understands. Sometimes I don't feel like I'm good enough, and sometimes I feel like I'm too good. And sometimes I don't fit in with people. And I've gone to all kinds of things. I'm an alcoholic, but damn it, alcohol is not my problem. I don't know what to make of this. And I stayed dying that street, and I had tried AA to the best of my knowledge, and it didn't work for people like me. I thought about all that when that guy asked me that question. Why is it some people stop drinking and some don't? I couldn't. And I had to stop thinking. There's just some people who cannot stop drinking. Why? Because they are not aware of how to do it, I guess. And on that rainy, cold morning, which was 42 years ago this month, I stood in that street corner. No front teeth. They'd been kicked out in the Phoenix jail. My clothes were gone. I'd lost them in Phoenix. My family was gone. My mother, I was an only child, and my mother was not allowed to accept phone calls from me anymore because my stepfather was so tired of watching me manipulate her to try to get some sympathy and maybe some money. I couldn't get a job as a dishwasher. And once upon a time, they told me I was a boy genius. Now I can't get a job doing anything. And what do you do now? I've often thought, and not only that, but in conjunction with that, having a smart, defiant attitude. I sometimes think, because of my long slippings, a lot of people refer long-term slippers to me. I see them all the time. They come from other parts of the country. They said, "You'd help me." In fact, a couple times, two or three times over the years, not so much lately, except I made it clear this is not to be done, but go to the door at 2 in the morning and find some boobs dead. They said, "You'd help me." In the distance, I see a car whizzing away across the park. Who said that? Who was it? He wouldn't tell me. I think, what would I do if I came to me for help? I don't know if I could put up with his crap. Dying loser with a smart aleck attitude and thinking he's really smart, knowing more than he does that it's fear and despair and he's trying to cover it up because he has to try to be like men look. I don't know what I'd do for such a guy. Because it's a funny thing, you know, we talk about, what do you do with newcomers who have a difficult time? Well, we tear down their ego. Then you got something to remember. They don't have any ego. They have deep feelings of insecurity and less than. And it turns out, on the long-term basis, you do just the opposite. If you can do them, get them to take actions little by little and help them trust you a little bit, you can build up their ego little by little. And if you can do that, those walls come down little by little. Because very few people come to AA feeling arrogant, I'll tell you that. They may hide behind that. They may even believe it. But it isn't arrogance. It's fear and lack of self-worth and insecurity. And I think, what do I do about that? What I did, I wanted to get out of the rain, so I walked 72 blocks to an AA club. I thought I could hustle some of those boobs. I hung around that club, and I hated it, these idiots and fools. And I had no idea that would be my sobriety date, because I didn't want to stay sober. And now here it is, as I said, 42 years. Now, what was different this time than any other time? And I said, I've thought about that many, many times. A few years ago, I was talking up in Toronto. They say there are no authorities in AA. There are. You know who authorities are? They're people who come from a long way away. Johnny Harris is an authority. Bob Bazan is an authority. People who come from a long way and speak. When you have conventions here, you get people from California and Minnesota and New York. When we have conventions in California, we have people come from New York and Minnesota and Texas and Louisiana. Down in New York, they have speakers come. As long as you're from far away, they're an authority. I am kind of an authority in Toronto. I go there every February. They have a day with Clancy, if you can imagine such a dreary thing as that. And that tells you all you need to know about me anyway. I mean, the good speakers go north in the summer and south in the winter. I work Texas in the summertime and Canada in the wintertime. I don't mind. But, you know, in the morning I talk about something like the history of AA or the steps or the traditions or something. Then in the afternoon you have a question and answer session, and at night I tell my story. And I've been doing that for some time. And I really like the question and answer period, because I discovered I have a natural facility to weave a verbal tapestry of BS while I think of the answer. Let's go back and study the roots of that question. A few years ago, I was talking up there, and a woman in the back said, "Clancy, I have a question." "Yes." She said, "If you don't mind, I wouldn't like one of your long answers." I said, "Somebody ought to slap that bitch." I wouldn't say a thing like that because I'm too nice a guy. But she said, "Every year you come up here and you tell us how long you slept and how terrible it was, and how long you've been sober and how wonderful it is. But you never tell us exactly how did you get from one to the other. Is there some kind of magic? How do you do that? Could you just tell me that in a sentence or two?" I said, "No, ma'am, I couldn't. That's much too complex." She threw off my rhythm, really. And just, I took a shower that night before the meeting, and the answer came. At least an answer came. I didn't like it very well, but an answer seemed to be the truth. And I wouldn't have said it anyway, because it's a nothing little answer. It's a two-bit answer. I like answers with a little body, with a little panache. I know there are newcomers here tonight. I hope they could leave saying things like, "Did you hear what Clancy said? Wet birds don't fly at night." "Did you hear what Clancy said? Never mind if the horse is blind, keep loading the wagon." Now, these answers mean nothing, but they give the newcomer hope. The answer I thought of that was so two-bit answer. This was the first time that my defenses ever went down enough, so I took some actions in AA that were beneath my dignity and I thought were stupid. I don't mean big actions like four steps. I mean little, tedious, two-bit actions. For example, I hung around that club and I lived in an abandoned car in the parking lot. Some guy left there last summer and I stayed there. I hung around the club, went to meetings, had no front teeth or grubby clothes, and got to be the club fool, I suppose, except I was much too slick for that, emotionally, I thought. But, you know, for example, in those days, there weren't any styrofoam cups. They hadn't been invented yet. Every meeting had the porcelain cups, so they all had to be washed after every meeting. And you do that for about a year, you're tired of washing cups. So they're also looking for volunteers. And the guy said, "You, there, boy, without the front teeth. You want to wash dishes for us tonight?" Now, if I had any strength left, I'd say, "No, I'd want to wash dishes tonight or tomorrow night or any other night. Why don't you lick them off with your long tongue, you old boob?" You know? But instead, I found myself saying, " Want to help us clean up the hall after the meeting? Want to come early tomorrow night and set up the chairs? It's just hideous. I felt ashamed of myself. I sold out my integrity. And little by little, I stayed sober despite all that. I lived at a man car night. Guys would buy me little meals once in a while in that club. And one guy used to throw me an apple about once a week, as I recall. I said, here, get somebody to eat this. You know. And I somehow stayed sober. And if you're kind of new, you'll notice this again and again. If you stay sober a couple weeks or 3 weeks, pretty soon people say, time to get a sponsor. Got a sponsor? Be very careful, because these sponsors all seem so nice. I want to help you. No matter how nice they are, sooner or later they're going to stick their nose in your business. And I used to see this actor come in and out of the club, and he was a character actor, and he was Bob Bailey, and he was a star, but he played loving roles. He gave people money in the movies and helped them, and kindly and wonderful. I thought, he'll be my sponsor. I'll get some money from him. I'll get my teeth fixed up. I'll get some clothes so I won't look like a bum. I'll go back to New York. I'll get a job in BBD and all, we're a big agency, because I wrote some good stuff in my day. And I'll save some money. I'll come back here and I'll buy this club and I'll burn it down. Remember I saw the movie Carrie a few years ago, and I thought, yeah, that's it. I mean, burn them down. So I said, Bob, would you be my sponsor? Sure, but I want you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. I want sobriety on an all-time basis. They like to hear that. And he became my sponsor. And looking back, he should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played in the movies. So they were foreign to his nature, I'll tell you that. It turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig. Just, I want you to do this, I'm right. I felt like Quasimodo. Here, Bob, you want me to ring the bell now? Now, many times I've looked back and said, why would I take that crap from that guy? Because I don't take crap from people. That's my whole stock and trade up to that time in my life. I don't take crap from anybody. I've quit big jobs because people gave me what I thought was too much crap. That's the way you want it? Get yourself another boy. The hell with you. I'm walking off the job. I know how many nights in bars people might imply that I'm not, maybe don't look very manly. You don't think so, son of a bitch? Try me. Let's go. And I get knocked on my can a lot. But they know I'm tough. I used to think after I was sober a while and feeling a little bit better, why would I always have to be so defiant? Another reason, maybe someone in here has this feeling. Because all my life, I guess I secretly knew that I was a weakling, and I hate it. I hate being a weakling. I hate being weak like a white worm crawling inside of me. And I would do anything necessary to keep anybody from finding it out. I'll fight you, I'll quit, I'll defy anybody. Remember the movie Back to the Future a few years ago? Michael Fox, he played the kid where as soon as somebody said, are you chicken? You'd have to do anything they told him. That's almost the way it was in my life. And I never realized that. Now here's the funny thing. If somehow you can overcome that long enough to stay around here and do some of these dumb things over a period of time, I discovered something strange, and I'm sure many other people have too. If you stay here, eventually you become strong. And when you become strong, then you can afford to be weak. But you can't afford to be weak when you're weak. You have to be strong when you're weak. And little by little, he got me to take actions that made me get a job, terrible job. I got fired off, and he told me to get another job. He didn't nurture me, didn't give me any medications. Psychiatrist Texas told me I'd need medications as long as I lived because of the intensity of my emotions when I was released from the hospital there. And when I was new, I couldn't find anybody who could give me medications on spec. So I had to live without them and had to do those stupid steps instead. And by the time I could afford the medications, I didn't need them. But little by little, I stayed sober. And by taking action. I want to tell the guy this whole story when he asked me this question. It would have taken the whole hour, of course, to. So I just said there are some people who seem to be unable to surrender, to take the actions necessary in AA. And that's the only difference. And as far as I know, that's the only difference. And it's that way all over. When I took the fifth step finally, I wrote a fourth step when I was 6 months sober, because I'd been staying in a guy's basement with he and his wife, and I got asked to leave because I put out some cigarettes under the sofa, and I wouldn't have said I had an ashtray on that side of the room. And I was back temporarily sleeping on an abandoned car, and I got a job, a guy named Mike Ross got me a job at the Daily Delicatessen and dishwasher, and I got fired the first day because of my attitude. And I decided to kill myself. And I, that day, I was going to just say goodbye to my sponsor, I guess, or do something. And I called him up, and I told him a sad, sad story, but my life was just, and he didn't have any sympathy. He said, I should write your damn inventory the way I told you. And I just explained to him the week before, I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. Why do I want to take it with an out-of-work actor? What are you going to do? Say, cut, reshoot that part? That's stupid. So I try to explain to him, Bob, you don't understand. There's something terribly wrong inside of me. I don't know what it is. It isn't alcohol. It's something wrong, and I need some kind of help. And writing about it and going over all my pain and agony won't help me. In my judgment, I need something much more thorough, much more cleansing. And he explained that to me. He said, in your judgment, who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it. You're a loser. You're a loser. I came out of that phone booth, I'd be so mad. I went back to the A Club and said, so, here's some paper. I'm going to write my inventory. And I wrote for about 2 hours on this yellow pad, sheet after sheet. I put crap down. I would never tell a soul. I swore I'd never, oh, dirty, petty little, not big, little. Time, once upon a time, he said, why don't you tell your psychiatrist those things? And because when you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why I don't tell yourself. I don't want some old puke to say to me, you did what, sir? Get out of my office. But first of all, wash off that chair. And I wrote, and I got done. It made me feel a little better because I felt at least it proved it didn't work. And a couple of days later, he came by and said, we'll take your fifth step. I said, okay. Just get in the car and shut up. We drove from Santa Monica to Oxnard. He gave me a flashlight, and I read this stuff. And it read even worse than I remembered. Oh, God. I thought, he's going to make me walk back from Oxnard. That's 40 miles. I may die. I got all done. I said, that's all, Bob. So are you done? I said, yeah. And he leaned over and he said, that's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. And I said, thought it was. I've taken that same trip over 200 times since then. On the driver's side of the car. And some other goof over there with a flashlight and the paper. Well, let me explain this part before I read it. That's the funny thing about inventories, I'll tell you. All good inventories, in my opinion, contain the same elements. The stories are different. The facts are different. It's all over the planet. But they all seem to sustain the same things. Lack of self-worth. Guilt. A lot of resentment. And occasionally lashing out at the world to punish them for hurting me. And knowing that nobody understands. And you hear that, and you hear it all over. And it's so amazing. And so a few years ago, I listened in one week, a daughter, one of the most famous men of the 20th century, and a few days later, she blamed it on her father because he was so famous. And a few days later, a guy named Ramon Pena, who didn't even know who his father was. And he blamed it on his father because he didn't know who his father was. And same, she lived in the penthouse, and he just got out of Washington State Penitentiary. Same inventory. It's just ridiculous. That's why AA works, because it works at a level that you can't see your judge. It works, it seems to me, deep, and little by little changes your perception of reality. Little by little, as you do these things, it removes, it replaces things inside, I guess. I don't know. And it's that way all over the world. I've been sober a long time, and I've been active all this time. Not because I'm especially dedicated, but because I get goofy when I get away from AA. And I've been asked to do a lot of things. Some of you haven't had a chance to do yet. I've been asked to come and speak in exotic places like Cape Town, South Africa, and Johannesburg, and Berlin, and London, and Oslo, and Paris, and Dublin, and Belfast, and all over Australia, and all over New Zealand, and all over Canada, and Mexico, and Central America, a lot of places. You'd think you'd really find exotic AA in these places. I always used to think, I'll find it really different. But except for the accents, you hear exactly the same emotions you hear here. The same feelings, some people, some reassuring other people, some people trying to teach people. Every group in the world seems to boil down to this. There are some people there who've been driven to AA by their pain and agony, have somehow allowed themselves to take actions whether or not they believed in them. And little by little, their perceptions changed. And now they are in AA and they come to the meetings on a consistent basis. They're feeling good. And in every group, there seems to be a group of people who, for one reason or another, will not or cannot take these actions, refuse to take the actions. And they sneer at the people who do, and they ridicule them and make fun of them and joke. And in the middle, there are the new people. And both of these groups fight for their soul. And it's amazing we keep as many as we do, because the way these people are feeling, the arguments against AA seem to make more sense than the arguments for it. And yet we keep some, and they stay here. And that's reviving. The action continues to work. And that's the only therapy I've had now since 1958, the actions of AA. And I certainly haven't become a wonderful person. I know I sponsor even more people, a lot of people who are better people than I am. But I'm the best client serviceman I've ever been, I'll tell you. And I live with some degree of dignity, and I try to be of service. And it's not because I'm a wonderful man. As a result of that inventory, I made some amends. I started off with my father, who I hated and hadn't talked to in 10 years because I felt he deserted my mother and I when I was little. I made amends to people. I went back to a university I'd been expelled from just 2 weeks before graduation and made amends to them, and on and on and on. And little by little, my perceptions changed, and I began to try to help somebody else for a change. It almost gave me a headache to even do that, take my mind off myself for a brief time. But little by little, I stayed sober. I finally got a job I held when I was about 2 years sober. And little by little, it worked out. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children were living in a post office box in Dallas. They heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way down there somehow. Leaped out of their post office box, rushed to my side. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. I bought a metronome then, so I got into the rhythm system a little bit better. Not tonight, Fred. And now they're all grown up. We talked at the table. All of them turned out well, except one daughter. She's a district attorney. I'd always hoped she'd be a public defender, but no. And I live in a house in West L.A. Everything is fine. Isn't that a nice story? And it seems so minor to say, oh, to the actions of AA. And it's not an innate active person. But I've been exposed to a lot of good people who have shown me by example. My first sponsor was a wonderful man. He made me do things. And he died. And then I got another sponsor who showed me how to do things. And he never made me do anything. But I tried to win his approval. I won his approval, to the best of my knowledge, by doing what he did halfway. People say, why do you travel all the time and all this time? Because that's what my sponsor did. And people say, oh, he's a fanatic. But I look at him and he always looked 10 times more comfortable than the guy who was criticizing him. There was a moral there somewhere. I'm still trying to make it out. What is that? And I'm not certainly example of AA, I don't suppose, a great example, but I'm an example that AA works for some awfully sick people. And probably the greatest gift I got in all these years, I came to understand my first year, the nature of my problem. I began to understand that I was an alcoholic. Now, how can I be an alcoholic when my problem isn't alcohol? Because I came to understand what AA says, and it says in the book, and the practitioners say it. An alcoholic is not a person with an alcohol problem. If that were true, we'd all be home free. An alcoholic is a person with an alcohol problem combined with a severe sober problem that makes it necessary to drink. And there's no way out. I don't suppose there's a greater disease of denial. I sometimes think about that. Over the years, I've had several people that I sponsor, that San Ramon for one of them, die of cancer in the West, in the UCLA hospice ward. Now, a sponsor job is go up and sit with them. I hate it after working. I hate sitting in the hospice ward, they're dying off. That's what sponsors are supposed to do. But Ramon was sleeping one night, and I was thinking to myself, what do these people in this ward do? I said, hey, guys, I got a deal for you. Would you come with me every night at 8 o'clock and sit with a bunch of people, drink some coffee, have a few laughs, meet some friends? Would you do that if I could cure your cancer? They would sign over their homes to you. They'd give you everything they got. You go out, maybe the worst place I've ever been, I think psychologically, doesn't smell bad, doesn't look bad, it's just a bad place, is the Los Angeles County Hospital ward for AIDS, charity ward for AIDS victims. They're all dying, and they're not already dying, but they've been thrown away by everybody. And I had a guy in there, and I remember standing in that place a few years ago thinking, what do these guys say? And I said, hey guys, would you do some things I told you to do, whether or not you agreed with them? Would you maybe surrender to the fact that you don't know the best way to handle yourself, and maybe write down some of the crappy things you've done, and maybe we'll go back over and talk about it and see if we can't go back and make some amends, and maybe we can help other people with AIDS and show them. Would you do that if I can cure your AIDS? They would crawl across the floor and lick your feet and beg you. But you go down two floors to the alcoholic ward, where a guy's laying there with his liver out to here, and his skin yellow, his eyeballs yellow, and he curses you if you suggest he go to an AA meeting. Down the ward. I'm not a goddamn alcoholic. Get out of here with that crap. Which is kind of funny, except you go back to the next meeting, a month later, he's been dead for 3 weeks, and there's somebody new in the bed. Now, if people 3 days away from death from acute alcoholism can prove they're not alcoholic, you and I can too. And that's how insidious it is. For example, today in America, where there's more sobriety than any place in the history of mankind, it is still estimated by some sources that about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk in the United States, or the direct result of drinking. And I'm sure they all die saying the same thing. But I'm not really an alcoholic, you see. My problems came when I was sober. That's when all the pain was. I just drank to get some relief, for God's sakes. It got a little out of hand. And they have no idea. That's the nature of the disease. And that's why it's so hard for us to come to understand sometimes. If your problem is not really alcohol, except when you're drinking, then you're probably an alcoholic. Because what we do in AA is not make good thing about that. We somehow, and it doesn't seem possible if you're new, and I wouldn't think so either, except it happened to me and countless people I've known, that eventually sobriety becomes bearable and then tenable, and much to my surprise, one day preferable to drinking. Because AA is designed to do what alcohol does, only much slower, to fill holes inside of you, maybe to make you feel the way men look. Not all the time, because human beings are fallible. But the actions of AA, you know, I think the great Gettysburg Address of all of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1950, Bill and Dr. Bob, AA was having such a terrible time, and they wouldn't accept the traditions. They had this convention to see if they could get them all together in Cleveland to try to explain it to them, and they read the traditions, explained that, come on, we're going to go the way the Washingtonians become extinct. But on Sunday, Bill gave a talk, and Dr. Bob gave a talk. And his talk, most of us have heard if you've been around AA, but it's such a great talk. He got up, he was dying of cancer, two guys helped him to the podium, tall, gaunt, dying man. And he said, I want to welcome you all to Cleveland. I hope you go back and tell the boys and girls in your cities that we're all on the same path, and I want to apologize for my health. I haven't been very good lately, and I'm happy that some small thing I did a few years ago has helped bring this about. And then he said something that to me is the the ongoing concept of what it's about. He said, I would indeed be remiss if I didn't call your attention to two or three things I found out. He said, first of all, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let us not louse at all and put Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientists, but have nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like this who doesn't know exactly what it means. Because we're all very nice when we're feeling good and all very pleasant. But if we're threatened or tired or cross, cut and slash and burn. And finally he said, let's never be too busy to help the alcoholic behind us. Give him a pat on the back when he needs it. Take him to a few meetings. He says, none of us would be here if someone hadn't done for us, he said. Let us never reach that stage of smug arrogance where we cannot do that. And he said a few closing remarks and sat down. And was dead a few months later. But that really is the concept of it all. And that's why I'm so a strong member of the activist wing of AA. And the action of AA consists mostly of getting out of self if you possibly can. And I need all the help I can get because I have myself in a self-wing guy. As a matter of, over a period of time, I took actions that enabled me to feel like I could live in the world. I took actions that enabled me to pray to God. I wasn't ashamed to pray to God anymore. And that was such a remarkable thing to come to believe in God after I would have bet my life I couldn't go back because I've done so many sins and the Lord with the church tells me I am doomed. And here I am. I believe God loves me. And I've believed it for years. I believe he loves you. I believe he loves us all the same. When I went to work yesterday morning in Skid Row in Los Angeles, where I work now, I had to step over the bodies of dying men and women. And you just point to me, does God love them? Yes, he does love them. They just have refused to take the actions that I was forced to take. That's all. It's that simple. I really believe that. The last thing I want to say is kind of an apostrophe of that to emphasize this, to underline it. When I was about 5 years sober, I was doing pretty good. I just had front teeth. I was making my move. My family was back. I'm about ready to become a secretary of the meeting. But I got a lot of the ball. I really did, too. Boy, I was hot. And there was the biggest meeting in town was the Brentwood meeting at that time. That's why they elected their secretary in some secret board of directors or trustees or some hideous thing. And I knew a guy, and I said, nominate me. I've been going to that meeting. They know I'm pretty good. I speak there. Nominate me for secretary. So I saw him next day. I said, did I get elected? He said, no, I died for lack of a second. I realized there was no groundswell movement for me to become secretary. And a couple weeks later, a meeting on this little Ohio Street building had died. And the guy said, that meeting died on Tuesday. Why don't you go and start a meeting? Yes, I will. And I went over there to 9 or 10 tattered friends and followers, and I wrote a little format, and I set up a meeting, and I called it the Pacific Group, because it's going to be mean peace and quiet for everybody, and I became secretary, of course. I remember standing at the door, the first meeting I knew of in the world, where the secretary stood at the door and made everybody shake hands when they came in. A lot of them didn't want to do it. I don't care, shake hands! And the first week we had about 10 people there, including the speaker. The next week we had about 14 people. And about 19 people. Then I guess my announcements offended some people. I was back to 9 or 10 again. Over a period of time, we were up to about 35 or 40 people at the end of the year. And I thought to myself, you know, this would be a good time, probably most groups, to have an election because the year's up. But it would be unfair to these people. They don't have a grasp yet of the concept that I can show them. I'm going to sacrifice myself and just be secretary again for another year without telling anybody. I thought, are you ever nice? Yeah. So I was secretary for another year. And at the end of 2 years, they were getting there, but God, they're like an emerging African country, not quite ready for self-government. I don't want to upset this. So I'll sacrifice myself a while longer. And one night, during the meeting, some boob came in whose life I had saved, nevertheless, needless to say. So we're going to have an election in this group. I said, why?
The group is growing. We're about 60 people. We're doing well. What do you want to say? Am I doing it wrong?
I said, no, don't be upset. He said, but people from other groups say you never have an election. And if we had an election, we could vote for you, and then nobody could say anything. I said, good idea. So I had an election, and they swept me out of office. But I had built such a good foundation that even after I left, the meeting really grew. And now I guess it's the biggest meeting in the world. It's 10 or 1100 people every Wednesday night. Many of you have been to it. It's an enormous meeting. And I'm not the secretary, needless to say, but I'm the founder. And I sit in the middle of my hall next to John and a couple of the guys. And I give little signals where necessary. Nobody pays any attention, but it cheers me up. At the end of the meeting, I try to stand around the meeting a little bit, and people can bring newcomers up. I say, this is Clancy. He's been sober an awfully long time. He founded this group, and he travels all over the world in airplanes to talk at other places. And I try to be nice. I say, hello there. I'm glad you're with us. I hope you brought your problems tonight. Many people leave them here. Once in a while, some puke will come up who doesn't know who I am. He says, I'm like, hey, buddy, can you give me a ride back over to the VA psycho ward? And the nice thing about AA, I learned in my first year, and I have to remember it my 43rd year. You can think whatever you want to. I can look right into sickle eyes and think, what? Did you arrive back to the VA psycho ward? There's 1,100 people here, drones, who need action badly. There's one who's given and given and given, for God's sake. I'm just not some nice-looking guy in a shirt and tie. I'm Clancy I from over the sky, bringing hope to countless people around the world, for Christ's sake. Now, I can think that as long as I say, okay. And the great thing about AA is on the way home, after I drop this puke off, my head says, oh, Clancy, is there no end to your goodness? That's why they say action is the magic word. Tonight, when my friend Brian started to speak, he said that he, through a power of Alcoholics Anonymous, he had had a drink since 1997. When I was first in the Texas Nut House, I got out of the electric shock ward, they moved me into another ward with some AA meetings. I'd never heard this before. You hear it in the South, not so much anymore, but you used to hear it a lot in Texas. You know, around most places you say, my name is Fred and I'm an alcoholic. Everybody says, hi, Fred. But in Texas in those days, they'd come say, my name is Fred, and through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it has not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind-sedating medications since my sobriety date. And for this, I'm really grateful. And they say, oh, Fred. I thought, God, if I ever got in a position to ask over, I wouldn't give them some kind of a song and dance like that. I'd tell them the truth. I'd tell them the things I'd found out, give them some hope. So I've come here tonight at tremendous expense and no little inconvenience to give you the truth as I see it, that I found it. It's just this. I found out, for example, that I'm an alcoholic. So I can say to you this to close my talk. My name is Clancy Emmisland, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it has not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind-sedating medication since my sobriety date, October 31st, 1958. And for this, I am truly grateful. Thank you.